What is the No Spin News all about?
You know that this is a fact-based analysis news program. You know that. We avoid speculation. We don't do conspiracies here. We don't do party politics here. We're not nonpartisan. That's wrong. Not that. Okay, we are advocates for a stronger America and a more just society. We don't believe in communism. We don't believe in socialism. We don't believe in nihilism. We don't believe in the progressive woke culture. We think it is un-American. We don't support that. So you should know what we are. And it would then crystallize what we do.
Listen to the No Spin News. Subscribe to Bill O'Reilly's podcast feed wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Josh Hammer, and this is America on Trial, your one-stop shop for all your legal news pertaining to the 2024 presidential election and all the major pressing legal headlines affecting our country and our American way of life. On today's show, we take a deep dive into what's happening deep down in the state of Georgia, where we finally have a much anticipated ruling as to what is going to happen pertaining to Fani Willis, the district attorney currently prosecuting the former president Donald Trump there, along with about a dozen and a half of his fellow co-defendants. Big news for you to report, all of that and more in today's deep dive. Then later on the show, in today's closing argument, we are continuing to track in our closing argument segments here what is happening in the Middle East. The Biden administration has formally slapped a wartime arms embargo on America's closest regional ally, the state of Israel, as it attempts to eradicate the Hamas jihadist organization in Rafah, their stronghold in Gaza. Lots to unpack there as well. Absolutely horrific, I would argue, borderline treasonous stuff happening from the Biden administration. I can explain to you why I think that is the case in today's closing argument segment. But for now, as always, let's begin by going around the horn. We begin where else but in New York City, where the criminal prosecution of Donald Trump, the first ever criminal prosecution of a former president of the United States, is set to resume today in the courtroom of Justice Juan Merchan. Most recently, on Tuesday, before their weekly Wednesday recess, we heard from Stormy Daniels, the discredited porn star who was on the witness stand giving lurid, incredibly detailed encounters of their alleged hookup in Donald Trump's hotel room back in 2006. There was lots and lots and lots of gratuitous information that was shared here, so much so that Juan Merchan himself, the judge, essentially said the Trump's attorneys, guys, why are you not objecting more often? He's trying to scapegoat them when he really ought to be doing his job a little bit better there. It is the role of the judge to balance the evidentiary importance of a piece of evidence with the possibility that extraneous or gratuitous information might prejudice a juror, which is why you had Trump's lawyers then after the lunch break on Tuesday come in and file a motion for a mistrial, which was subsequently denied as well. In any event, Stormy Daniels is likely to retake the stand today, and we are expecting Trump's attorneys to engage in what I anticipate could be a popcorn-inducing and at times tense cross-examination. I want to just underscore how absurd this is, just very briefly. The former president of the United States, running for re-election again, deprived of the campaign trail 4 of the 5 days of a given weekday, having to sit there and be subjected to a porn star giving tawdry and salacious testimony of an alleged affair that happened on one night 18 years ago. And oh, by the way, the presidential candidate and criminal defendant himself has this sprawling and unconstitutional gag order placed on him, so much so that he can't even speak up, defend his honor, and punch back against what is being said. I mean, the whole thing is just absolutely bat crap insane. I just feel a need to underscore that. But in any event, we are expecting Stormy Daniels to retake the witness stand today. Will be interesting to see how that cross-examination goes, if all things do go according to plan. From New York City to Washington, D.C., we have an update for you when it comes to TikTok. So another thing that we were tracking in America on Trial is the debate over the legislation that has been working its way through Congress and that Joe Biden ultimately signed in April. This legislation that was ultimately packaged as part of the sprawling foreign aid bill to Taiwan, to Israel, Ukraine, and so forth. And the TikTok bill essentially gives ByteDance, the Chinese-based parent company of TikTok, it gives them 9 months to find a buyer to offshore, to outsource and sell TikTok to, if you will. Otherwise, TikTok is going to face the distinct possibility of just being banned in the United States. I thought this was sound and prudent legislation. I thought that the bill very carefully delineated a difference between a company that is a national security threat insofar as it is owned by a Chinese, Russian, Iranian, or North Korean parent company and one that is not. Others were concerned about possible slippery slope effects, but in any event, the bill now has been signed into law. Well, TikTok is now suing. TikTok is arguing that the bill violates the First Amendment. They are saying that it violates their users' First Amendment right to free speech. They are also saying that divestiture from ByteDance is, quote, simply not possible. It is not commercially, not technologically, or not legally possible. Here's another key excerpt from the lawsuit as it's been filed. Quote, for the first time in history, Congress has enacted a law that subjects a single named speech platform to a permanent nationwide ban. Now, I want to just reiterate my basic take on this, which is that the First Amendment has literally absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with whether a foreign organization, a foreign corporation can operate in these United States. I think back to the Cold War in the United States. We could have had the exact same debate back then at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis in JFK's presidency in the early 1960s. We could have had the exact same debate back then as to whether RT, Russian or back then Soviet propaganda, we could have been debating whether or not RT had a First Amendment right to spew Soviet propaganda on American airwaves. So by the same logic, we could be debating whether or not TikTok has a First Amendment right. It doesn't make sense. If you are not an American citizen, arguably, if you are an American corporation, because going back to a late 19th century U.S. Supreme Court case called Santa Clara Railroad, U.S. corporations do have constitutional rights in this country. It's actually something of a legal fiction. In fact, when Mitt Romney had that infamous gaffe that maybe wasn't so much of a gaffe when he said that corporations are people, my friend, that's actually basically correct under U.S. Supreme Court case law. We can debate whether it's correct as a moral matter or ethical matter or whether it even should be correct under United States constitutional law, but it actually is correct under most law. But if you are a U.S. corporation, then yes, you are going to have something closely approximating constitutional rights. That simply does not apply for foreign corporations. This idea that TikTok and its users have a First Amendment right is absolutely insane. If I am a U.S. citizen, I do not have a First Amendment right to have unequivocal access to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hamas propaganda deep in the bowels of the internet that teach you how to make homemade suicide vests and bombs and all of that. That's simply just not how the First Amendment works. I ultimately do expect this TikTok lawsuit to get thrown out, but it is newsworthy and notable that they have decided to file this lawsuit in the first place. Finally, our last update for today's Round the Horn segment. It is worth noting that Marjorie Taylor Greene, the firebrand congresswoman from Northwest Georgia, she made good on her promise to file a motion to vacate the chair and to attempt to oust Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana as part of his comeuppance for supporting that sprawling foreign aid bill that we were just discussing in the context of TikTok. Marjorie Taylor Greene is not a fan of Mike Johnson, perhaps because of his stance on Ukraine above all, but more generally speaking, because Mike Johnson, and here is where I actually do sympathize and indeed agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene, it is true that Mike Johnson did renege on his word when it comes to making sure that the U.S. southern border is adequately secured prior to giving out all sorts of foreign aid money. I deeply sympathize with her on that substantive allegation and assertion. However, that did not necessarily mean that this was a good idea to go ahead and file this motion to vacate. What did Marjorie Taylor Greene think was going to happen? It was very obvious that the votes were not there. And sure enough, there were only 11 Republicans who ended up being opposed to her move to table this measure here. You had 196 Republicans that actually embraced keeping Mike Johnson in the speaker's chair. The overall vote, 359-43. Even Democrats, 163 in support of keeping Johnson, only 32 against. This looks to me like a big loss for Marjorie Taylor Greene. I guess I give her the credit of her convictions by following through. But at some point, maybe you just kind of count your losses and don't bother to follow through here. again, I'm not an apologist for Mike Johnson at all. On the contrary, I wrote a fairly blistering essay for Tom Klingenstein's website, tomklingenstein.com, last Thursday, entitled The Tyranny of the Uniparty, and the editors of that site used a photo of Mike Johnson as the photo. I criticized Johnson in the essay, and I think that he is worthy of criticism on any number of issues. But again, you have to have a game plan here, guys. And I do not think that Marjorie Taylor Greene had a game plan here. And I'm unsurprised to see that this vote has failed and that Mike Johnson is going to remain in the speaker's chair. Okay, that's it for today's Around the Horn segment. Up next in our deep dive, we're going back to Georgia, folks. It's been out of the news for a little while, but we're going to talk yet again about Fani Willis, Scott McAfee, and that whole cast of characters down in Georgia. We've got some big updates for you. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike Slater from the podcast Politics by Faith. This is a crazy time in our country. It's stressful, a lot of anxiety, and it's going to get worse. And I realized that one of the things that helps me take away the stress is realizing that there's nothing new under the sun. So on this podcast, we take the news of the day and we run it through the Bible and other periods in history to realize that we've been through this before and we can rise above again. Politics by Faith, anywhere you listen to the podcast, Politics by Faith.
Welcome back. It's time for today's deep dive. So last we checked in Georgia, it was the middle of March, right around the Ides of March, March 15th or so, when the district court judge there, Scott McAfee, finally handed down his ruling after this evidentiary hearings where you had Fani Willis and Nathan Wade take the stand to talk about the contours of their extramarital affair. This really was the story that was gripping us in Trump legal world for weeks on end. And then Scott McAfee handed down his ruling where he basically, it was a very convoluted ruling, if you recall. He was essentially trying to pull a John Roberts. John Roberts is the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. John Roberts is infamous for trying to make everyone happy. He is infamous, at least in my circles, among my lawyer friends. He is infamous for trying to make everyone happy simultaneously, to give some crumbs to the conservatives and then give some crumbs to the liberals. He is the king of trying to concoct and hand down these mealy-mouthed, somewhat inexplicable, middle-of-the-road opinions that involve Solomonic baby-splitting attempts, trying to create this balancing test to do that, and just trying to basically take the path of least resistance, which, you know, ironically, contrary to the people who think like this, the path of actual least resistance is to just judge and rule in straightforward fashion and to say what the law is rather than to try to be too cute by half. But I understand that being too cute by half is very tempting for people, especially smart people who go to fancy law schools and do stuff like that. So in any event, I digress. Scott McAfee tried to do this. He basically tried to pull a John Roberts. And what he said is he went through what was uncovered as part of the evidentiary hearings. And he did say that there is a lot here to be very concerned about. And he actually even went so far as to say, that there was a, quote, appearance of impropriety that was created by the personal relationship that had Fani Willis and Nathan Wade shacking up for months or years on end. Now, one of the debates at that time, if you recall, was whether or not it was an actual appearance of impropriety or a demonstrable acts and a realization of impropriety. That was really the debate at that time as to what was the actual standard, for dismissal in the case. And in something of a mealy-mouthed opinion, Scott McAfee, the district court judge, largely agreed, not entirely, but largely agreed with Donald Trump's lawyers that an appearance of impropriety can at times suffice to require dismissal of a district attorney. However, again, in his attempt to try to do the thing that would make everyone happy, he didn't do the remedy or didn't implement the remedy that would logically follow from finding that an appearance of impropriety is sufficient for dismissal. And then he found that appearance of impropriety. No, on the contrary, he actually tried to do something very different than that. So he found this appearance of impropriety and then said, okay, so here's what I'm going to do. Nathan Wade, you're the special prosecutor who was hired by the Fulton County, Georgia DA's office. You're the one who was shacking up, sleeping with Fani Willis. You're the one who's been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars of Georgia taxpayer dollar, cool hard cash. You're the one who was taking Fonnie Willis on all sorts of trips to the Bahamas and Miami, San Francisco, you name it. Fonnie was apparently paying you back in cash because that's not sketchy or anything. What McAfee, the judge, did was he said, Nathan Wade, okay, you're off the case. You're donezo. But Fonnie Willis, you can stay. What he actually said was that one of you needs to go, one of you has to stay, but it was fairly obvious who was going to have to go and who was going to have to stay. That came down on a Friday morning in mid-March, maybe Friday afternoon, just a few hours later. Sure enough, Nathan Wade was out and Fonnie Willis had announced that she was staying on the case. And then immediately the Trump legal team tried to appeal this, tried to say, okay, well, this is really not how Georgia law actually works. This is an incredibly 2Q by half attempt at a remedy here to fashion remedy from the judge. So can we appeal this thing? Finally, yesterday, on Wednesday, May 8th, the Georgia Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court sitting above Scott McAfee, over a month and a half later, they technically had 45 days, so this was getting towards the end of their timeline here, they finally said that they will formally consider this appeal. They have granted the request. They have granted the request to consider whether Fonnie Willis should indeed be disqualified from this criminal case that she is pushing here on RICO grounds against Donald Trump and his co-defendants, Scott McAfee's 2Q by half district court remedy to the contrary, notwithstanding. So they're taking up the case is the upshot here. The Georgia Court of Appeals has granted the certificate of review. And this thing's just going to drag on and on and on. I mean, that is kind of the conclusion here that is relevant for you, the listeners, that the Georgia Court of Appeals is going to hear this thing. It's probably ultimately going to wind its way even beyond that to the Georgia Supreme Court, given just the nature of this case, the high profile nature of the case, the parties involved in the case, the prosecution of a former president in an election year. All of this is going to have the effect of kicking this can down the road even more so. And as I like to remind you sometimes, the Georgia case was already going to be the last case out of the starting gate. It was already supposed to be the case that wasn't supposed to make it a trial until August. At this point, I find it very, very difficult to believe that this case is going to get anywhere close to a jury prior to November. That really is your upshot from today's news out of Fulton County, Georgia. It is very good news for the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, and really just underscores how desperate the Democrat lawfare complex currently is to get a verdict and a guilty verdict at that in the Alvin Bragg case in New York City, because that really is the only case that's actually going to make it to a jury verdict prior to November. That just gets more and more obvious, frankly, by the day. Well, that's it for today's deep dive. Up next in today's closing argument segment, the Biden administration sullies itself yet again when it comes to Israel and Gaza, all of that and more, some sordid details for you folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's time for today's closing argument. The Biden administration has confirmed, Joe Biden personally confirming to Aaron Burnett of CNN last night, which corroborates New York Times reporting and other reporting on this matter, confirming that they are withholding weapons, essentially putting on an arms embargo to Israel, to their military, the Israel Defense Forces, right as the IDF is going into Rafah, has engaged in initial combat in Rafah, which is Hamas's southernmost stronghold there on the border of Egypt. It is where the remaining Hamas battalions are located, roughly 4 to 5 of the remaining Hamas battalions. That is where the remaining hostages are believed to be located. That is where Yahya Sinwar, who is the Hamas chief in Gaza and one of the masterminds of the October 7th massacre, it is believed that is where he is located. There has never been any doubt in the minds of the Israeli military and security brass as to whether Israel had to go into Gaza. On the contrary, everyone knew all along that they were going to have to go into Gaza. Nonetheless, the Biden administration has been telegraphing for quite literally months now, at least in February, maybe even earlier than that, that they opposed it, that they opposed Israel going in to finish the job in Gaza, which, as I've stressed time and time again, is the logical equivalent of telling the Allies in World War II that you can't actually make it to topple Hitler and the Nazis in Berlin. Rather, you have to stop short and you can only conclude your hostilities, your combat operations in Dresden or in Frankfurt or something like that. The Biden administration has now announced that it is withholding weapons to Israel as it attempts to finish the job in Gaza. It is denying not just large 2,000-pound bombs, which the administration is focusing on, but it is also halting a shipment of 500-pound bombs. It is holding up a joint direct attack munitions, which can convert unguided bombs into precision smart bombs. It is holding up small diameter bombs, and it's been sitting on tank shells and mortar rounds as well. Look, I have two points to make. One is that Congress already appropriated and allocated this aid. They literally just voted on this a few weeks ago. This aid was allocated by the Congress. What in the world is the Biden administration doing in not doing what the Congress has just appropriated using its own power of the purse? The last I checked, if Democrats had a modicum of intellectual consistency in their bodies, which they do not, but if they did, they would recognize that this is exactly on what, on a much smaller scale, they impeached Donald Trump for in 2019, for trying to impose some sort of quid pro quo on foreign aid disbursements to Vladimir Zelensky. Do you remember that five-page ridiculously small, trivial, non-consequential phone call that Democrats were wetting their panties over and decided to impeach the guy on? Insane. So if they were at all remarkable, if they were at all consistent on this, they would recognize that what they did then and what they did now, that both of these should be impeachable behavior. The most important point of all is to recall there are still U.S. citizens trapped in Gaza. There are still U.S. citizens held hostage by Hamas, which is a U.S. State Department recognized foreign terrorist organization in Gaza. For Joe Biden to deny weapons to an allied U.S. military that is trying to get and rescue those hostages, to evacuate them from the jackboot of Hamas, to undermine them while simultaneously trying to save and bail out a State Department recognized foreign terrorist organization is not just vile, it is getting dangerously close to actual treason under the formal definition of treason. Again, U.S. citizens are still held hostage there, and the commander-in-chief is so gung-ho and so high on his own supply and trying to appease the unappeasable radical jihadis in Dearborn, Michigan, that he will simply not give our ally weapons to evacuate our own U.S. citizens. It is sickening behavior, and God willing, this absolute disgraced nincompoop of a senile commander-in-chief will pay a hefty political price for it at the ballot box this fall. That's it for today's America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We'll be right back with you tomorrow morning.